Cold War might bring to mind the Kremlin, the Berlin Wall, or the Bay of Pigs crisis.
But there were sites right here in Wisconsin that were linked to that global conflict of the U.S. and its allies versus the Soviet Union and the countries under its influence. And some prominent players also hailed from the Badger State.
Chris Sturtevant is the author of Cold War Wisconsin. He's also a U.S. Air Force veteran and chairman of the Midwest chapter of the Cold War Museum in Washington, D.C. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's briefly recap what led to the Cold War. The U.S. and the Soviet Union were allies in World War II. What happened?
Well, it dissolved pretty quickly after that. A Milwaukee native named George Kennan was on the scene as one of the first ambassadors to the Soviet Union, and he noticed that there were people disappearing. Joseph Stalin would not receive him anymore. None of the ambassadors were giving him the respect he gained during the war, and that led him to write the long telegram and form the basis of the containment policy. So the Soviets, of course, had a lot of troops still in Eastern Europe. We evacuated that area. They were intent on continuing to force those governments to lay claim to Soviet rule, and in a sense to stop the carnage from the World War, from the two World Wars, from Germans driving west, or east rather. So things did dissolve really quickly after that.
And so George Kennan, as you said, was a key figure in how to deal with the Soviet Union. He was from Wisconsin. What did he propose as a way to contain the Soviet Union? What was at the core of that?
He wanted to publicly, I guess, the United States wanted to recognize that borders were where they were, the Soviets were where they were, but then he would go ahead in a clandestine way to support what was called Operation Rollback, and that was to recruit men of military age that had come as refugees after the Second World War, train them, and then go into those countries in a clandestine fashion to support popular uprisings, to support governments being toppled from the Soviet standpoint, was a very mixed bag, in most cases failed spectacularly. It was actually part of the Marshall Plan. Something we don't hear about a lot is 5% of those funds actually went to unspecified funds like embassy upkeep, but they would in turn use it in Albanian currency or the Baltic states to support these efforts.
And so this was a philosophy, a plan that started soon after World War II. It was really very current and still being followed decades later.
Up until 9/11, I mean, you're talking into the 2000s, that was our policy. We were going to react. And lessons learned in Pearl Harbor, caught with our pants down, 9/11, caught with our pants down. We're not, our eyes really aren't on where the real enemy was for many, many years. And so we've had to kind of pivot, so to speak, over the last 15 years, 20 years, to the realities of the world.
So a real terror of communism and what it could mean if it spread was really key to the Cold War and how people thought about the Soviet Union, about its satellite countries. And few names are more closely associated with that than Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy. Tell us about his role.
Very famous, famously known as the being part of the Red Scare, the second Red Scare. We actually had a Red Scare back in 1919. But this is the more popular one that people would recognize in a living history sense and things that we learn about. McCarthy came on the heels of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was more of the Richard Nixon era, going after Alger Hiss, Whitaker Chambers. So when McCarthy came to power, he then focused on communists in government and picked a very ripe time where China had fallen to the communists in 1949, and the Soviets had detonated their atomic bomb. Korea was being invaded, so it got a lot of push and support from the public, especially here in Wisconsin, to root out what they felt was a very real threat.
Let's hear a bit of an interview that Senator Joe McCarthy did on June 25th, 1952.
You see, if you have a committee, the power to subpoena investigators, mm-hmm. you don't use the same tactics you use when you have no committee, no power to subpoena, where you've got to dig and root out the communists and the crooks and those who are bad for America.
Yeah.
Where you have a committee, so you have the power of subpoena, you can get the records. And if we have a Republican president, We'll be able to get those records, I'm sure. It will be a less spectacular fight, but much more effective. You see, it's difficult when you're all alone with the entire power of this federal bureaucracy against you. Difficult to dig them out. Even at that, you see, we have exposed, gotten out of government 11 of those I originally named. Some of them have been convicted, others before the grand jury, but all out of the government under the loyalty program.
So he really saw himself as a crusader, and this was a very personal thing. Where did this belief and this commitment come from for him?
I really think he truly meant it and believed it. I think he had a duty. He was a United States Marine. He was a World War II veteran. He had a very small town values here in Wisconsin. Believed that it was his duty to go after what he felt was being eaten up from the inside. Strangely, it sounds kind of like the deep state today. You know, there's a lot of parallels with that type of thinking. But McCarthy, certainly that internal drive to find these individuals that were responsible. Certainly, we didn't know until the Venona decrypts, until the 1990s, that some of these people certainly were communists in the government. But at that time, I had a lot of difficulty finding anybody to sign on to his way of doing things. And we know the rest of the story and what he happened with the alcoholism and then being censored from the Senate.
So he was very committed to, as he said, rooting out communists in the government. What kind of proof or lack thereof was he going on?
It would be the testimonies of other people. I mean, it's usually a he said, she said. Were you a member of the Communist Party at one time? And many of these people were. They were card carrying because they thought that was the future in the 1930s. We had Americans, Americans here from Wisconsin that thought this went to the Soviet Union, thought they were just going to get a job at Ford Motor Company, help build cities. They really believed these things until they found out about the Nazi aggression pact, or the Nazi-Soviet pact. So maybe a lot of these people had that communist membership, went to the communist meetings, had some infiltration or connection to working in the government. So that was the proof, so to speak, and that's what he went on.
And what turned the tide against him finally?
Well, it was the Army hearings. He brought up General Marshall, the Marshall Plan. He had some semblance of, yes, he was very accommodating to the Chinese. They were talking about General Marshall. He was in charge of the fort that's in New Jersey where the Rosenberg Ring had worked and operated. But the public wasn't ready to hear that. The public didn't want to believe that a war hero like General Marshall was behind and he was accommodating these Soviet interests. And so I think it turned the tide that way. And of course, the Democrats took power in 1955 and then were able to kind of tamp him down.
We're talking with Chris Sturdivant about his new book, Cold War Wisconsin. And Chris, Manitowoc, Wisconsin has a long history of ship and submarine building, and I'm guessing the Cold War period was no exception. How did Manitowoc contribute to the Cold War effort?
That area in general, I'll include Kewaunee and Manitowoc, but we'll go with Manitowoc first. That happened to be a site of a Sputnik 4 crash in 1961. And Sputnik, of course, was the first artificial satellite launched by a country, which was the Soviet Union. We were in a space race, clearly, in 1957. Soviets got up there first. It's a big 180 metal sphere. It was beeping back and forth to places on Earth where you could listen through shortwave radio. It really scared us because we couldn't hide anywhere militarily. We couldn't hide from the Soviets and the communist menace. Our response to the original Sputnik, of course, was the Vanguard project. The old footage, you can see it just falls right off the launch pad, blows up. The press has a field day saying it's Flopnik, Kaputnik. And that was until Wernher von Braun took over and got our first satellite up in the air in 1958. So Sputnik, in a general sense, really scared people. And then the rocket systems, of course, would be used by the Soviets to take Laika up into space with the dog. Yuri Gagarin would go up and be the first human to orbit the Earth. And then the fourth Sputnik would be tracked by amateur astronomers and moon watchers, so to speak, that would be looking for it to fall down. And they knew kind of within a window of 3 days when it would come. They just didn't know where. And it turned out Sputnik 4 crashes on a street in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, right in front of the Rahr West Museum. And you can still see today a ring that commemorates where it landed.
You have a great photo in the book of these two police officers standing in the middle of a street. And you wouldn't thing to look down at their feet unless you need
unless
to
you
look,
look down there.
And there they are standing there with this imprint. I mean, it obviously it had quite a bit of velocity built up, this imprint of part of Sputnik.
And that was the kind of the comedy of the situation too. You've got a couple of beat officers, early morning hours, they see something in the road, they think it's cardboard, they keep moving. Hour later or so, they're going back. They realize they got to get it out of the road. It's very hot. They start kicking it to the curb. A few hours go by. Oh, we heard that Sputnik may have crashed in the area.
Maybe so we should go back and take
exactly,
a look at
that
thing.
And they ended up getting somebody who happened to have connections to the Milwaukee Journal, or the Milwaukee Journal, or the Sentinel, whichever was operational at that time. There was a businessman up there. He took it to the Milwaukee Journal or Sentinel. And then it ended up back in these government agencies. They all chipped away at it. It's a 20-pound rock. When they found it, it's 14 by the time all of our alphabet agencies get to it and all the science labs give it back to the Soviets. And that's definitely a good portion of the book that people would be interested in reading.
And Manitowoc as a submarine and shipbuilding area. Mm. How about that?
They were active, of course, through World War II. They had a number of these. So the biggest example I can think of would be the small boats, the river boats in Vietnam. But, of course, there's quite a few more. The Kewaunee shipyard would be the USS Pueblo, and that is a ship that's 50 years later still inside North Korea. That was captured in 1968. The crew members, 82 of them, one of them died in the firefight, released 11 months later. They kept the ship. And I happened to go on that ship 3 years ago. I was on the USS Pueblo and got to visit and see firsthand what the horrors they went through. And then, of course, got the North Korean side of, you know, what happened and how wonderful they were treating these prisoners and so on and so forth. But so the USS Pueblo, again, an international incident still held as a trophy inside North Korea from Kewaunee, Wisconsin.
We're talking with Chris Sturtevant about his new book, Cold War Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the Cold War at its height? What was it like living under that cloud of fear and dread? Were you or someone in your family in the military then? What was that like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with author Chris Sturtevant about his book, Cold War Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you learn about the Cold War in school? What did you hear from your parents at home? Is there a Cold War site near where you live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Now, Chris, a large part of the Cold War was being ready at any time for a potential attack by the Soviet Union, and that meant weapons able to take down incoming Soviet bombers. Tell us about the Nike missile sites in Wisconsin.
Those were placed around most communities, or large cities around the United States after World War II. We had 200, what we called Nike Ajax missiles. They were surface-to-air missiles that would be tracking incoming Soviet bombers, which would make their way over the North Pole as the shortest route to come destroy American cities, especially here in the Midwest. So Milwaukee had 8 of them. It was part of a larger ring of supersonic steel, if you would. It was part of the Milwaukee, Gary, Chicago ring, which had over 30 missile bases. The ones in Milwaukee, 8 of them at one time, the conventional warheads, they then shrunk down to 3 when they went nuclear, and that would have been in Waukesha, that would have been in Brown Deer, north of the city, and then the Milwaukee Summerfest grounds would have been the third site. There was one missile base, nuclear Nike base, that was in west of the city outside the Twin Cities as well. There was one located inside Wisconsin, just inside in the state line there, but most of those were part of the Minneapolis cluster. So this would be our surface-to-air defense. These would take place of the turret guns and that we think of during the Second World War.
So it seems like these are pretty high security, secret military installations, but you say that people around them had a pretty good idea of what was going on, maybe not details, but that there was something there.
Yeah, I mean, there were houses around the Nike site in Waukesha, for example. So there were those were residential areas, largely farm areas that the Army would come in and procure the land for and do these. They were basically cookie-cutter designs, three missile pits in one area that would house the missiles. And then about a mile or two as the crow flies away, they would have the fire control area, which would have where all the men would be stationed, as well as have these radar tracking systems. They would be tracking either the missile, the incoming bombers. Some could toggle back and forth, but there were several on the Waukesha site that I can give more a little bit more details.
Let's go to the phones, and John in Chippewa Falls is up. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I was talking to your screener. I think your guest answered my question. Anyway, it was about a site near Roberts, Wisconsin. I think it was a Nike site, and I visited it. It's currently some sort of storage area. It's not owned by the government anymore. Hmm. I guess I was just asking about that, and maybe I just missed your answer already.
And I don't know too much about that site itself. I visited in a lot of the Southeast sites, which have turned into places that just have storage. Some of those bases were in Waukesha. I'll speak about Waukesha because it's a good example. In 1970, under the SALT Treaty, a number of these Nike sites disappeared simply because of the upkeep and trying to keep them operational. They were obsolete because the Soviets had gone to intercontinental ballistic missiles. And then they were transferred to parklands for usage of parkland. In Waukesha, Donald Rumsfeld actually signed over the deed, and then Waukesha received it in 1972 with the intent of having parkland on there. But a lot of these sites followed suit with the same situation, but many would fall into private ownership hands. Some would be in just like private property, private housing developments. You know, boats would be stored in these missile pits. The one in one of the sites in Muskego is a manufacturing plant. Mm. So even though the government says you have to do X with this, somehow locally they end up in these. A number of them ended up in private hands, but many of them are used for storage. Even the one in Menominee Falls right now is used as a park. That is a park, but that's used for a lot of storage as well.
Hmm. John, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and Elaine in Colfax is up. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I think your guest is maybe too kind about Senator Joseph McCarthy. He was ruthless, and there were accusations made against people that they were just outrageous lies or exaggerations. And people's lives were destroyed. People committed suicide. And he was just reckless with this information. He became more and more, I would say, unhinged or insane. And his alcoholism was a contributing factor.
Yeah, thanks for that call. I want to make sure that we have time to address that, Chris.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with any of that. Those are things that we do know about. I have 30 seconds to answer these questions. These are simply just highlighting McCarthy as the politician, the man. And I go over some of those things in the book as well.
Thanks for that call, Elaine. And Chris, in your research, what did you learn about how much the Cold War really permeated everyday life for the residents of Wisconsin?
I'd say many of them, it really depends on what area you lived in. You know, I've met people that, as children in northern Wisconsin would go up on these viewing platforms or on the top of school buildings and get binoculars and be looking for Soviet aircraft. You'd have women auxiliary groups that would just take the volunteering time, the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts, they would just be sent up for hours on end looking for these Soviet aircraft. They would have the silhouettes. So this is the 1950s. People were certainly... they were certainly scared of nuclear war. We watched it. I watched it growing up in the 1980s, all the movies about Damnation Alley, the day after, the movie about the escaping my mind, Red Dawn, would be another one. So people watched this in public in a TV sense. So it permeated us in many, many different ways.
When I was preparing for our conversation, I looked on the Wisconsin Historical Society's website, and I found a photo of a Wisconsin family with its new fallout shelter that had just been delivered, and you can actually see that image at WPR.org. Was that a common feature in homes of the time?
I think there were some people that were jealous they didn't have. When I talked to some people, they thought the person down the road had a fallout shelter, so therefore they wanted one. Maybe it was kind of like the new color TV sets in the 60s. Like they wanted one. They wanted to feel safe. Whether or not they would have been active you know, actually something that would have kept people safe, or for what period of time, you know, who knows, but probably not, you know, not a lot. Obviously, there was a cottage industry and nuclear fallout shelters, but I'm sure that wasn't every house, unlike like Switzerland or some of these countries actually have, where you have to buy a seat in a fallout shelter, but so not as, you know, widespread as that.
Chris, a very short chapter in your book might be what stayed with me the most. It was about an event that took place in Mosinee, Wisconsin on May 1st, 1950. Tell us about the Day Under Communism.
That was organized by the American Legion. The American Legion had long been an advocate of taking on communism. Even in our, as an American Legion member, we have an oath that we say before that says to support and perpetuate 100% Americanism. So they knew the Red Scare even back from 1919. So 1950, Northern Wisconsin, they wanted to demonstrate what a day under communism would be like. So they did this mock day on May 1st, of course, the workers' holiday, that they had soup kitchens going. They took all the books. They arrested the mayor, who ended up dying a few days later of a heart attack. The minister who died also like a week later, 10 days later, was really just absurd. But anyway, you know, it was just a way for people to react and respond on a local level, what they felt like was a real issue and was a real security threat. TASS came to, you know, the Life magazine came to cover this, and it was certainly a day that we kind of look back and think, what is going on there? But on the other hand, it was their response and what they could do to demonstrate exactly what it would be like to live under communism.
I wondered reading that whether it had any kind of a War of the Worlds effect where some people tuned in late kind of and thought it was really happening.
It could have. I think they were given some notice. I think they're given notice. And actually, the Communist Party of the United States, some people, they were actually distributing flyers the night before. So it got a response even to the local people on the ground there.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Christopher Sturtevant is a children's librarian who lives in Milwaukee. His interest in the Cold War began while growing up during the 1980s, and he is the author of a new book called Cold War Wisconsin. And you can find out more about that at WPR.org.